Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing on this great guest talking about critically important topics. And today we are going to award the winner of a 9/11 debate. This was sponsored by ANITA, Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness. The winner is Dr. David Griscom. We're going to start out with Rick Shattuck of ANITA, the Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness. Welcome, Rick.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Yeah, ANITA rhymes with Norman Medata.
Oh, I thought it rhymed with my friend ANITA.
And to ANITA, a lot of perpetrators. It's on 1629 K Street in Washington, D.C., lobbying Congress and law enforcement for a new investigation of 9/11.
Very interesting.
Early this year, we decided to sponsor a 9/11 physics debate between two top physicists. The requirements would be a PhD in physics from an accredited university and at least 50 published scientific research papers. The debate would be 1 hour and on a popular radio show. To find a physicist for 9/11 Truth's side, we looked on patriotsquestion911.org and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth petition signers and found Dr. David Griscom, who went to Brown University, worked at the Naval Research Lab, and was selected by NASA to study the moon rocks, a very competitive position. He has also received numerous awards. We sent an email and Dr. Griscom accepted, so that was easy. To find a PhD from the other side, we sent an email to the physics departments of about 30 universities, including the Ivy League, Harvard, and Yale, plus MIT, Caltech, and Stanford, plus Colgate and Maharishi University, where I graduated from and know some physicists. We also emailed the American Physical Society and the German Physics Society, the DPG. We asked for a PhD in physics who would argue on behalf of the 9/11 official conspiracy theory that the World Trade Center towers collapsed due to fire alone, and explain how steel beams went 600 feet to stick into the American Express building. Basically, how Newton's laws of physics were upheld. We received some good wishes for the debate, but no PhD in physics was interested in debating for the government's story enough to apply. But lots of people on the James Randi debate forum are very willing to argue for the official story. They don't generally post their real names or degrees, but may know some physicists who do. So we posted a notice there. However, the forum moderators kept deleting our posts, saying they were, quote, off topic, even about the debate date and time of the debate. One member with integrity and a fair debater, Reverend Chris Moore, posted it for us. We gave them 2 weeks more, but they responded only with insults and no qualified nominees with a PhD.
Very interesting.
We had as the initial target date March 1st, which was near the time of the Sochi Olympics in Russia, so it was to be called the Physics Olympics. However, we had not received any applicants by then.
I think all those guys at JREP were too busy watching the Olympics.
Yep. And disparaging the need for having a debate in the first place, although the JREP forum is supposed to be about fair and open debate.
And of course that's contradictory, because if they say that there's no need for debate, it's so obvious, well, that would make it really easy for them to win the debate, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. We did receive one applicant, Frank 3373 from JREF, who said, have him come on JREF and I'll debate him. However, it turns out he, and I know who he is, has a bachelor's in liberal arts and no science courses, much less physics. He's never published an article in his life in a scientific journal and has a Hirsch index of zero. And the Hirsch index, as you discussed in your last show, is an objective indicator of scientists' respectability in the scientific community as measured by the number of studies in peer-reviewed journals that he's referenced in. So the debate topic would be resolved. The laws of physics are broken by the official story, so an independent official investigation should be done on 9/11. So We don't have any qualified applicant to debate. I guess we could ask Dr. Grissom to say a few words about why he feels that the laws of nature are broken, which is the Newton's laws.
Okay, David Griscom, you're a very highly qualified physicist, and the only taker you could find for this debate challenge was a guy who at least does have a liberal arts degree, so he should know better. So you have a Hirsch index over 50, which is pretty good, and apparently there's...
Yeah, that's actually pretty good. I don't like to tout these things, but... in fact, when it comes to 9/11 truth, it does sort people out. I think that you will be hard to find a really good physicist with a high Hirsch number who will have stay with the official story.
that's interesting because some of the issues involving the apparent violations of the laws of physics, according to the official story of 9/11, are not exactly Einstein-level issues. I mean, are they? I mean, go ahead and tell us about a couple of them.
Okay, well, I mean, the no-brainer is the fall of Building 7, which was in free fall for a period of time, and it can only have happened if with demolition. All parts had to have failed instantly from top to bottom, and so that's a no-brainer.
Let's stop and explain what that means. So basically, for this 47-story building to come straight down into its footprint for, 2.5 seconds or so of absolute free-fall acceleration at the beginning, and then pretty close to free-fall acceleration all the way down, it took less than 7 seconds, that means that all the vertical supports essentially had to be taken out almost instantly and simultaneously in order for it to come down that fast and also that symmetrically straight into its footprint.
That's right. If something falls down at the speed that gravity pulls it down, that means that there's no resistance. If there were resistance, it can't go that fast.
And how could all resistance just suddenly disappear unless you have cutter charges taking out the vertical supports in the precisely timed sequence that's necessary to take out the vertical supports?
That's absolutely right. And actually, you've got to do it a good job to get it go straight into its footprint. If you're a little bit off, why the building's going to fall over sideways.
Right. And interestingly, we haven't heard any patents for wastebasket fire skyscraper demolition companies or anything since 9/11, which indicates that nobody really believes that you can take down a building like that in that particular way with ordinary office fires.
Exactly.
Okay, tell us about some more laws of physics issues in 9/11.
Okay, well, I'm looking at World Trade Center 1 and 2. They're going have material flying laterally, something like 600 feet in all directions from each of the faces of these buildings. Okay, and we are supposed to believe that is it's not as simple as the World Trade Center 7, where everything went straight down, and you say all these things have to break. But for them to try to say that the World Trade Centers 1 and 2 were also everything broke that it broke, you would... If everything broke, as the official story goes, by it's too brittle and it just broke, and so the building fell down, there is no force that goes laterally. The force of gravity is straight down into the ground in the direction of the center of the Earth, and there is no energy in the falling material to push things laterally. Those have to have been explosions.
You know, I did have a science professor, Denis Roncourt, on my show a couple of years ago, who tried to argue that it's conceivable that the two towers could have come down from these plane crashes and fires, like NIST says. And when I pointed out this very issue, that why do we see things being blasted upwards and outwards? How can gravity be doing that? His response was, things bounce. And there was a tremendous amount of energy gravitational energy unleashed when these buildings came down. And with that much energy unleashed, just about anything could happen. So how would you respond to him?
The energy is a vector, is directed direct downward. And you could maybe have some angular thing to drive it out to the side a little bit, but it wouldn't go very far. It would come, it would keep accelerating downward.
So there's basically too much stuff going, you know, going too fast, too much mass going too fast sideways, and in some cases even it looks like a little bit upward when those drain centers are.
Yes, it does. It does look upward, and also in some of the work that's shown in videos, it appears that they're rocket propelled. Some of these external frame have a trail of smoke behind them, and those seem to go catch up with and pass other stuff that's falling there. And so it's those things.
David Chandler, right?
Yeah, he's the one that did those, right?
Yeah, and if people want to see this themselves, they can go to North Tower Exploding. Just feed that into your YouTube search engine and see that YouTube film by David Chandler, North Tower Exploding. And what you're seeing there, if you look carefully and think about it, you're seeing a building blowing up. You're not seeing a building just falling down. Those are, the key laws of physics issues here have to do with the way gravity works in both of the buildings you've discussed so far. And maybe you could clarify, though, about the rocket issue, the rocket-propelled objects. What could be pushing a rocket, or rather, what could be, leaving that trail as these objects are accelerating past other objects going sideways away from the exploding World Trade Center?
It's a simple one. It's a material when you get iron and aluminum together and you burn it.
You're talking about like the thermite, nanothermite issue?
Thermite, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, yes. So we've seen actually in the videos that were done, when you burn thermite inside a metal piece that contains it, it blows out wherever there's a hole where it can blow out. And so if thermite had been put inside of the outside columns of the building, and I wouldn't bet that they weren't, as soon as they break loose, the remaining burning thermite on the interior would be a rocket propulsion for that particular piece and make it move faster than it would if it was in free fall.
Very interesting. Any more physics issues you would like to bring up in case somebody from the James Randi Forum or some other person who apparently would believe that the destruction of the Trade Center did not violate any laws of physics, according to the official story. Any other issues to touch on?
Well, okay, you had fires that burned underground for a couple months, and that is supposed to, that the official story is that some office furniture, that even though it's mixed with concrete dust, is burning, but it's burning at a higher temperature than office furniture would even burn if it had a supply of oxygen. And that has to be leftover thermite that was burning down there.
Could that possibly be nuclear?
No. This is not not a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactors, you have to push the isotopes together to make them critical, and here the stuff is spread out. But as we well know from the work of Niels Harit and others, there are pieces of tiny pieces of thermite found in the dust from the collapse of the buildings, and the I think it's the USGS or whatever, they flew an airplane over there several times after the occurrence, and they did infrared measurements of temperatures of the materials that are outside the buildings. And it's all outside the building, it's not inside. You know, that if, again, coming back, that if all vertical pieces somehow shattered by some law that we don't understand, it would still go into the basement of the building. And if there were thermite there, it would be in the basement too, but most of it was outside of the buildings. So, yeah, that's another part of the picture. I mean, there's an enormous amount of heat coming out of that. It would have been enough. I did a calculation once to run part of the town for a month or so or something. So,
so there was an immense. There's a lot of heat in these fires that burned for months after the destruction of the Trade Center. There were all sorts of reports of molten metal as well, and
part of it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And that, of course, it would be impossible as well, because there's no office fire that can melt steel, period.
Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that puzzles me about the apologists for the official story is where they get this all this molten metal, these hot spots, and you know, things like that. There, even in Building 7, there was that New York Times article about one of the structural steel pieces from Building 7 that had been warped, twisted, turned into Swiss cheese, and not only had it shown signs of the steel being melted, but it actually evaporated, which happens at a much higher temperature even than melting. Obviously, normal hydrocarbon fires can't do that. New York Times is on record putting this out there, calling it the deepest mystery of 9/11. Even the people I've brought on, like Denny Runcour, who tries to, or even Frank Greening, these guys who are trying to say that, well, maybe something bizarre happened to the towers, and you know, but even they can't explain how this piece of Building 7 would end up with signs of evaporated as well as molten steel. And we have the NIST guy. What's his name? The NIST lead guy is on record saying there's no evidence for any molten steel.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's just lies. And actually, the whole country, including the mainstream media, lies on everything. That's something that goes on nowadays. They just don't tell you.
Indeed.
But actually, talking about the NIST lying here, there's a little backstory that I have. That I had, you know, I worked at the Naval Research Laboratory, where they didn't disgrace themselves by coming out and saying that the things that the NIST said. So I had this thought that if I was working for NIST, I'd be disgraced personally as a scientist there. And that I would probably want to give away what I discovered in some sneaky way and get it into the literature. And so I actually went and found a paper by a guy working in metallurgy at NIST, and he was an invited lecturer at a major conference, and he described pieces of the outer steel metalwork of the North Tower that was not damaged by falling to the ground, so that it was in exactly the same condition as when it was hit by the airplane. And they found that the airplane, the largest stress given to the building would have been the airplane hitting it. And they could see where the top of the fuselage had hit this, and that there was a ductile effect that was squeezed and squished inward. Now that basically gave away put lie to the premise that that steel was rattled enough that it should shatter, because if you have ductile change, that means that there's no shattering. You're not even near that anymore.
So these were the perimeter columns we're talking about?
The perimeter columns, yeah, right. Okay. And his department in NIST investigated this thing and did find where the aircraft hit it, and said it said explicitly that this would have been the largest strain that the building would have felt, period, right there. And it is a ductile deformation, not shattering. So basically,
right. The
idea that anything could have shattered after that is out. And this is from honest guy, okay, at NIST.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So if, in fact, these buildings had actually collapsed rather than having been demolished with explosives and cutter charges, then there would have been this ductile sort of gradual deformation of the columns.
It would have shattered. Like, it would have shattered. Ductile is the opposite of that.
But what I'm saying is that given that the perimeter column was found to have had this ductile deformation, that means that that had these buildings started to come down, or something was going to make them come down, they wouldn't do it all at once so quickly
shattering into pieces.
Instead, they would sort of bend and fall over. So it would be a slow kind of process.
That is exactly the point. But some things, you will get some ductile changes if you heat the thing hot enough, which requires an external heat source, because the normal office fire doesn't get anywhere near that much to make steel bend at all. But the neat thing about this NIST employee, he's fairly high in NIST anyway, but said this is that point that they studied was the hardest hit, the biggest shock of any part of being hit by the airplane, and it was ductile. It did not shatter.
Interesting. Maybe I should invite that guy on my show. NIST whistleblower.
He's just happy as to have gotten it out, but he probably still wants his job.
It sounds like he's using the neocon method of telling the truth, which is that you put the truth very far between the lines, so only the elite can see it. The truth is too dangerous to be spoken in the public square, flat out. But that's what we're doing here at Truth Jihad Radio, is speaking the truth flat out in the public square. Well, so going back to Rick, are we going to be seeing any other any future debate opportunities here, or what's going to happen with this? You put up a $1,000 prize for whoever won this debate, and it was going to be determined by audience vote, but I don't think we have anybody else that could have won the prize other than Dr. Griscom.
I'm not taking that money, of course.
Well, it's high noon on the Ides of March, and we gave a two-week extension, and it would have been nicer to have two physicists debate, two top physicists. And we at the Association for 9/11 Truth Awareness did what we could to get the word out. So there should be thousands of physicists, from the way some people talk, who advocate a natural collapse and the official theory. So it's surprising that there are not any scientists or physicists willing to defend the government's story or their own reputation. Here we find NIST being publicly disgraced and no one comes forward. So as you said, we were going to open the vote to the public, but however, since only one physicist responded, even with a two-week extension of time, therefore on behalf of the Association of 9/11 Truth Awareness, we are awarding the $1,000 honorarium to the scientist who feels strongly enough to stand up for his side, going to the charity of his choice. Do you have a recipient in mind?
Well, I think
congratulations.
It should get back to you, Rick, to your work.
Well, that's a grand idea. Thank you. But we're happy to donate the $1,000 to good 9/11 truth projects.
There is a fundraiser that's going on to get a new study on the World Trade Center dust to be done at an independent laboratory. It's a project being headed by Mark Basile, and that's our primary focus at this point. Does that sound fine with you?
That sounds fine to me, yeah. I mean, he's done really nice work. I stand behind that.
That's a great idea, yeah. Because it seems like that nanothermite study, especially according to you, Dr. Griscom, that's been, it's a really, really good first-rate study. You were one of the peer reviewers on it. And it seems that in order to get that message out and, confirm how trustworthy and how important this study was, a replication study like this would be a great idea.
Yes, I agree with that. But actually, I want to make a point on that, is that I've refereed at least 600 papers, which I actually went back and checked with my paper records, and I think some records on early computers got lost, and been doing some more recently. So I'm between 600 and maybe 900 papers that I've refereed. And I really get in. I don't do superficial work, so that even if it's a good paper, if I find something I could make better in there, I suggest that for these people. And so when I got the Read It All paper to referee, I read the whole darn thing, and I couldn't find anything to say. So, I mean, that makes it one of the best papers, or the best paper that I've ever refereed out of 600 to 900 papers I've refereed conscientiously. And that is sort of a measure that you can't find any place else, but that is a correct measure, because there are people who get, you know, trash Read It All's work without any merit. So you need somebody that's got a reputation first, and this is where the Hirsch number comes in. Again, I don't like to brag, but I am pleased that my Hirsch number gives me more credibility. And I think that we need more physicists out there with higher Hirsch numbers, and you need to reach them. I think taking the kind of thing that that the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth were putting posters out, I think if we could add to that poster some other things for physicists, and then get it into physics departments all over the country, that would be the way to.
That's a great idea.
Start. Yeah, right.
You know, I think I'll try and do something here at University of Wisconsin. Is there an easy way I can look at, say, the physics department there, or the engineering department, or what have you, and figure out who has what Hirsch numbers?
You can. That's a good thing. I mean, a good question. Google Scholar actually gives Hirsch numbers, but I think it maybe only gives it to the people that own it. I'm not sure with that. And it used to be that it was you could only get it from a rather expensive service now, but there's a number of outfits that are doing this, Google being only one. So, yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can just go to the department and try and find, you know, wrestle somebody up without necessarily knowing. But it would be kind of a time saver if we could look at Hirsch numbers, if that's what we're looking for, is it 50-plus Hirsch numbers?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, okay. But, okay, you're trying to find a debater and so on. But I'm trying to get alert to bring physicists who are still buying the official story because they haven't thought about it.
Yeah, well, this would be a way to do it, is, you know, put out this,
yes,
you know, we've got this debate challenge going, nobody took it in the past, and so on and so forth. And also, we should point out, just to remind people, that the importance of that nanothermite study is that it did find these red-gray chips of nano-engineered, highly incendiary, or even explosive, if not high-explosive material, that shouldn't have been there. And so it's a smoking gun of something on 9/11. We don't, you know, there may have been other factors of demolitions as well, but this is kind of hardcore smoking gun evidence of something that shouldn't be there that could have been used in taking this down.
That's absolutely right. I mean, actually, there was an enormous, you extrapolate the amount of dust in a small thing of thermite in particles in one small batch, and you extrapolate that over the total amount of powdered concrete, and it's a huge number.
Herod was actually puzzled by how huge it was, he says that still needs to be explained. And there are those who attack the nanothermite hypothesis by saying that that's too much. How could all, you know, who could have possibly planted all of that nanothermite?
Mm-hmm. That's about the weakest defense you can ever make.
Right. It accepts most of the thrust of the argument.
People can do anything if they want to badly enough, and they have enough time to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm an eyewitness to a couple aviation stunts around the National Airport and the Pentagon that goes back, the first one before, around 1990 or earlier, and the second one I know was after 1993, and they were flying these planes dangerously in routes that particularly the first one, I won't go into great description, but I was sure that the only reason they were doing that was to figure out if the Pentagon could be attacked in that manner. I mean, there were two planes. The one was a prop plane, which was quite slow, flying high, and below it, a jet fighter plane that barely hanging onto its envelope. It could have crashed into the city of Alexandria, which was sort of scandalous. Mm-hmm. And I called to radio stations and so on, trying to find out if they know of some operation going on. Nobody knew about it. And they came around and they did that twice. So I thought that, well, okay, they're seeing if somebody could attack the Pentagon that way so they can make countermeasures. And, of course, there were no countermeasures. And the people who did that operation weren't reprimanded, so QED.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it very well could have been in the planning for a very long time. Some people even wonder if the towers weren't expressly built for this purpose. They'd reached the end of their usable lifetimes, and there are all sorts of indications that neocons mm-hmm. have been thinking about a big coup d'etat in America since Luttwak's coup d'etat was published in 1968. Wolfowitz and Pearl and those guys sat around with Leo Strauss, their guru, talking about how to stage a big coup d'etat like this in America throughout the 1960s. We've been told that by two independent witnesses who studied with Strauss and the Straussians at University of Chicago, Stanley Hilton and Francis Boyle. So there are all sorts of indications that this had been in planning for a long time. Well, we reached the end of our half-hour show here. Thank you, Rick Shattuck of ANETA, the Association for Relevant Truth.
Say that replication is the key to scientific research, and thank you, Dr. Griscom, with your generous donation to the new study, which will replicate the Herrett and Jones and Farrer study, and I'm sure they would welcome your suggestions on getting it published.
Okay, and thank you, Dr. David Griscom. It's been great. Keep up the terrific work, and I look forward to catching up with you guys both real soon.
And happy to be on your show today.
Thanks. Right. Good to have you.
Congratulations.
Yep, congratulations, too. Yeah. All right. Bye-bye, both of you.
Yep.
Thanks,
bye.
Thanks, David.